Sports Stories with Heart. This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Audio Journal's Sports Stories with Heart, a program by, for, and about human interest stories in sports that touches the heart. These stories include local high schools and colleges of Worcester County and Central Massachusetts, as well as national and international athletic people and events. This program is brought to you by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind. My name is Mr. Ron, and I start today by introducing a gentleman who has a great background and a great history and makes it a special favor to be here today. Marvin Pave started with the Boston Globe right out of high school. He started back in 1961 and worked in the sports department as an office boy. He later became well-regarded as a sports writer, and he continued with the Boston Globe as a writer for many, many years, almost 40 years, and he retired in 2005, but is currently still affiliated with the Globe as a Globe correspondent today. Welcome, Marvin.
Thank you, Ron. It's great to be here.
It's my pleasure to have you. And I guess we can tell fans that this is a time when we're turning tables, because Marvin and I first met 37 years ago when he introduced me and took an interview, and now I get the pleasure of interviewing Marvin. And I think we'll start right back at the beginning by finding out how Marvin got such a sports background and interest.
Well, it goes way back to my childhood, growing up in Dorchester, Massachusetts. The family was together, my parents, my grandparents, before we eventually moved to Milton, where I really grew up. But in that household, my dad, High Pave, who was an attorney, was a baseball shortstop at Boston English High School, a great sports fan. And the second half of that equation was my uncle named Herb Ralby. Herb was a longtime sports writer for the Boston Globe. He was publicity director for the Bruins. And can you imagine, here I am one day, and who walks in for lunch at our home but Red Auerbach? Herb invited him over to come over for lunch. I was probably 6 or 7 years old. And there was the coach of the Celtics. And it was a constant stream, whether it was in Dorchester or when we moved to Milton. There were a lot of sports figures would come and visit, mainly because of Herb, who made many friends, and especially at holiday time with some of the Bruins' young players. He would invite them to the home for the holiday. He would invite them on occasion, and they'd have a place to go. And I grew up with these folks. I can remember with the old projectors, and you pull down the screen, and you'd have the old uke line, Horvath, Stasiak, and Busick, and the basement of the house. We were having something to eat and drink, and Herb would show the Stanley Cup movies from the previous season. So I grew up with all of that around me, and I also loved tagging along with my uncle, because his publicity director, his office was at the old Boston Garden. I would go into his office afterwards. He would have a big ledger book before the era of computers, and he would get all the out-of-town scores and statistics off of the wires, and he would keep a meticulous journal of every player and every game. And so when he would write the program notes for the Bruins programs, he would always draw upon that big ledger book. And he did that pretty much until computers came into vogue. But for most of his career, he relied on that book. It was like his Bible. And I'd be right alongside him watching. I would watch him write his stories. And I caught the bug. I loved hanging around. I can remember sitting in his office in the old garden and remember hearing the train go by on Causeway Street. And we would drive back home to Milton together. I grew up with it. And my father was a great sports fan. And I wrote a memoir for the Boston Braves Historical Association a few years ago about my dad. Believe it or not, Ron, we used to go to the Braves games, now Nickerson Field. And a fellow from the Braves did a big pop-up into the stands. And my father, who used to do this on Franklin Field in Dorchester, it was nothing to surprise me. As the ball came down, he reached behind his back and caught the foul ball. And they gave him a standing ovation. I was all of about 10 years old watching that. So I had some great influences. And when I was in high school, I really hoped that I could go to the Globe someday and start even at the bottom rung, which I did. And my first job, the summer of 1961, right after high school graduation, I used to go into the advertising department, put on the old headset, and we would call the local golf courses. We would get their scores, and then we would turn them over to one of the editors, and they would publish the scores from the local golf tournaments. And that was my very, very humble start at the Boston Globe.
Well, Marvin, even though you say it's a humble start, you never forgot the high schools. And I see that at some time you helped with the formula for the high school Super Bowl.
Yes, there were two of us, myself, when I was high school sports editor of the Globe in about 1970, and my great friend from Milton High School, and still is, Bill Abramson, who worked at the Herald doing high schools. And we were in charge of the rating system, which was published every week of all the schools, different classes in football. But basically, we thought, Bill and I, that it was time to see, and with the advent of artificial turf fields and other factors, that we felt that the game should be played on the field to determine, an Eastern Mass, Western Mass champion. So we went over all the rating system. We changed it so that it was more equitable. We called some of the local colleges and universities to see if they would make their fields available, and that was BU, BC, Harvard, Western Mass, Springfield College. And we came up with a system. We also factored in all the weather forecasts for early December for the previous 20 years. And eventually we presented the whole new rating system and proposal for a Super Bowl to the Football Coaches Association and also to the old Headmasters Association, which was the forerunner to the MIAA. They took it under advisement. They waited a year before they established the game. They needed more study. In 1972, the Super Bowl became a reality, and I covered both of the Eastern Mass games. And that was the beginning. And you got to give a lot of credit to the High School Football Coaches Association and to a gentleman named Ed Schlunz, who was the chairman of the Football Coaches Football Committee. We worked closely with Ed, who is still around. He's in his 90s, and he's older than you, pal. And he is absolutely a giant when it came to establishing the Super Bowl. And Brookline High was very involved in this because the head of the Headmasters Association was a fellow named Bert Holland, who, along with Eddie, were a great 1-2 punch in pushing this through and also making it reality. But we came up with a formula. They took it and ran with it, and the Super Bowl is still around since 1972.
And you were honored by the Massachusetts High School Football Coaches Association and the Massachusetts Interscholastic Athletic Association as a founder of the Super Bowl. And now we have more Super Bowls than ever before because it's become statewide.
Well, it was Eastern, and as I recall, in Western Massachusetts at the beginning, the first year. Mm-hmm. But, what we wanted to do was give the coaches the opportunity to now take over the ratings, to take over the venues that that we started. And what you have today is, this is in line with what they're trying to do. For better or for worse, a lot of these tournaments, you know, almost everybody gets in now. And I don't know if it's good or bad. All I know is that they had a framework, and what you see today started with simply, you know, a very small number of games. Only two teams went in every division.
Now it's exploded all over.
It's all over.
And right here in central Massachusetts, they've had some very successful high school teams.
They have, and you got to, the thing is, you know, football, I think that it actually, it was, you know, high school football, we were growing up, it was spectacular. It was very, very popular. I think it had waned a little bit, and I think that the Super Bowl, you know, reestablished the interest in it.
That seems to be true. Every year we hear more and more about the Super Bowl, and the only problem they have is with some coaches having problems with Thanksgiving game and the Super Bowl coming so close together.
That's a tightrope walk, you know. And they've tried several times to, you know, making the Thanksgiving days important, and then it goes the other direction. I think that it's still being debated. I frankly love covering Thanksgiving Day football. My family didn't love it because I was always late for dinner, but I loved it. I can remember, you know, I lived in Newton for many years, and I would go over to the hill at Needham High School, and I would watch the Needham Wellesley game. And I remember actually writing a story of how that game began, and it had a lot of meaning. But I'm not so sure it's as important to some fans and some administrators now as it used to be.
No, and of course, football in Massachusetts or football in New England is looked down upon generally by the national scene. But we seem to have developed more available 3- and 4-star recruits for some of the colleges today.
I think, yeah, look at the free agents and the draft this year, the players that went, again, as usual, from Boston College and from some of the, someone was taken out of Merrimack College, but local athletes. And I think that that's an upward trend. And so I would agree with you, but I also think that, you know, the draft, I was watching it recently, the recent pro football draft, and boy, it was like a stage show, you know. It was like, I thought it was like overdone, but that's the way they want to do it, that's fine. But I remember, you know, when you look at some of the old drafts in basketball, hockey, stuff like that, now they're all, you know, on ESPN. But I remember Tommy Heinsohn in an interview once was telling me that the way he was drafted was he got a phone call from Red Auerbach, who said, "Be down in Marshfield for training camp next weekend." That's how it was announced to him.
Well, that's where television has come in all sports. Today, it's television time and television money that seems to dominate.
It's not surprising. The part that I don't like seeing, you know, being dominated is the part about sports betting. You see her in the middle of a Red Sox broadcast, and boom, they're in the corner of the screen, the odds of somebody getting a double in the fourth inning or something. And, you know, that's you know, it's money because they're paying for that advertising time. And the ball team, Major League, they, you know, that's more money in their pockets, but it doesn't enhance the quality of the broadcast, you know?
Well, it seems to be in most sports today, these betting parlors are partnering with the sports organizations. And it is difficult, especially when we look back in history of some of the famous athletes that were thrown out of baseball, especially because of gambling. And now gambling is part of the whole scene.
Yeah, I mean, it's like an accident waiting to happen. Something will happen. I'm almost assured, and I just feel in my gut that it's easy now to, you know, to have access to all of the odds, to Vegas, to here, to there, and somewhere, you know, a couple of players have already fouled up and they've been suspended.
Yeah, we've had point shaving in the past. Even locally, we had college involved with point shaving. And that is something where these gambling organizations have so much money to offer to the athlete.
Yes. And this doesn't relate to the scene of today, but the Bruins had a player suspended for life back in the 1940s. His name was Don Gallinger. He was a very promising young player, and he bet. He loved to bet. He liked to go to the track, and they all loved that. But he was caught betting against the Bruins, his own team. And if he had admitted his guilt to the president of the league, they would have given him a second chance, but he kept saying he didn't do it, and it was proven that he did, and he was thrown out of the National Hockey League, banned for life. He wasn't reinstated until he was about 70 years old.
And Pete Rose was banned for life.
Yeah.
And now the president of the United States has gotten involved, where he suggested to the baseball commissioner that Pete Rose should be reinstated and allowed to be added to the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, well, I don't want to get into politics, but that doesn't surprise me. Doesn't surprise me.
Tell me, did you ever have a vote for the Hall of Fame?
No, I wasn't in the Baseball Writers Association. My role at the Globe for many, many years was, I don't know, maybe I was like the guy who can play second, third, short, and the outfield. I covered all the major pro teams and a lot of I always would be like, I would write a lot of what they call sidebars. I would do a behind the scenes story on that particular game. Sometimes if any of the major sports teams, if their beat writer was needed a night off or whatever, I would hop from one to the other. But I knew them all. All of the players and managers and so forth. I love covering baseball on a summer night overlooking the Prudential Center. I love the old Boston Garden. I wasn't in any associations, but I covered many, many, many of the games of the pro teams. And I'll tell you a fun story. One of the games I covered was the Red Sox, way back in the 90s, and they had a player who, shall we say, was somewhat overweight and loved to eat. Mitchell, he used to play for the Mets and came to the Red Sox. And we had access to the locker room before the game, and I was taking a few notes, and there is Mitchell with a big stick of pepperoni, and he's slicing it off. One piece, another piece. He must have eaten the whole stick, right? And he ate so much of it, and he was so, oh, man, he got sick. He got sick. He vomited right into the wastebasket, right? And so he couldn't play. So in the press release that said that Mitchell will be unable to play tonight because of a pulled hamstring, you can't say that he overate.
No.
You see a lot of things, believe me, and some of them you can't really put in a book. But at the same time, I always enjoyed the camaraderie with writers and athletes when it was on a one-on-one basis, when you could sit down and really chat. Different now, but I was very fortunate to have written all those years in the 70s, 80s, 90s. And
who were some of your favorites?
Well, there were some. You could pick almost any Boston Bruin. The hockey players were the most down-to-earth of all the athletes, not disparaging the other sports. You could always get a good interview with a Bruin. And the man who always came out, and I had great respect for, win or lose, was Ray Bourque. Mm-hmm. The Bruins had a triple overtime game loss in 1990 to Edmonton, first game of the Stanley Cup Finals. And the players were exhausted. They were getting IVs. They were getting extra fluids. The only guy who came out to the locker room to be interviewed was Ray Bourque. He was the only one. And I can remember that. And I said, how this poor guy must be feeling. He must have played 40 or 50 minutes. And he just sat there, loved to talk to us, but he felt that he should represent the team. And he spent as much time as we all needed And all the others were like sprawled out on the trainer's room. It was a hot, tough ordeal. But I remember that because of, you know, the class that this fellow showed. And you know as well what a great hockey player he was as well. I enjoyed the hockey players. I remember back then that they had a goalie named Reggie Lemelin. Mm-hmm. And he and Andy Moog were two good goaltenders back in the 90s, 80s, and 90s. And Reggie had this great expression. He said, somebody asked, well, what's it like to be a goalie? And Reggie would say, he said, well, some night the puck looks like a beach ball. And other nights it looks like a golf ball. And that's the goalie's life, you know? And, but I love those, I love those moments when you could sit and chat. And I actually like the days when the ball game I was covering might be rained out at Fenway. And I had to write a story, and I would just find somebody to sit and chat with. And one of them was Mike Maddox, who was a veteran pitcher. And we just chatted and chatted about, you know, he was about, you know, into his 30s. And we talked about what do you do as a pitcher as you get older? How do you adapt? And we went into this terrific conversation. He couldn't have been nicer. There were no, you know, distractions. And I remember writing that column. I still have it as an example of what you can get when you have a little bit of privacy, a little bit of time, and that you're showing a genuine interest in the person you're talking to, not just trying to fill newspaper space. That was always very important to me, you know, showing the interest in who I was writing about and not just doing it as a matter of, you know, habit.
And how has that changed now that they have all the television involved and the players are now wealthier than they were, so they don't spend as much time?
Well, they're not as accessible as they used to be.
That's
right. And that was what made it so much fun. They're not as accessible. So a lot of reporters and electronic media, they get the same quotes. You see them all the time on different channels. But let me tell you what I tried to do. It wasn't always relaxing, but I can tell you that I would try to stay in the locker room after a game, almost to the last man, the last media left, because I wanted to get in those important one or two questions that would make the story better. Because in the final analysis, you always want the reader of your story to kind of say to themselves, you know, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. And I would try to think of what happened out there that the reader should know that doesn't quickly come to mind. That was my formula, and it was fun, and I loved it.
Well, there's one old Red Sox story that I'd love to have gotten to know why. When Gene Conley and the second baseman, Pumpsy Green,
yes,
abandoned Yankee Stadium and wanted to fly to Israel.
I wrote many obituaries of famous sports figures, local sports figures, from around 2005 up until about a year or two ago, and Gene Conley was one of them. And I recalled that story, and to the best of my recollection, they had gotten shelled by the Yankees that day in New York. And Gene was not in a good mood, and I don't know what happened, but they wound up in what we should call a drinking establishment. And I think maybe just having a few drinks, I don't know the exact story, but they wound up going to the airport, and they were going to fly to Israel. And I don't know why either, except that I think it was Pumpsy that left first. He said, I don't want to do this. Gene Conley wound up, they went back to the team. But that was a legendary story.
But, absolutely.
But if they went to Israel, I mean, who could they have played for, right?
Nobody knows why they picked that. But
I'm not sure. That I don't know. But I do know that they got walloped that day at Yankee Stadium. And Gene was just feeling, I need a cold one. And Pumpsy joined them, and then the whole thing mushroomed.
And the Red Sox have had several unusual stories over the years. The time that we heard that you needed 25 cabs and 25 people to carry suitcases.
Yes. That was, you know, I think that was kind of over-exaggerated, but it was not exactly untrue.
Clements.
Maybe somewhere in the middle. It all goes to camaraderie. But there were cliques, if you recall. You know, remember the Bill Lee and his crew and all that. So I think now, I think the players have a little, you know, one thing that I do notice. And you and I would recall, you remember when, if you were standing on first base after a base hit for the Red Sox, and you started talking to the first baseman from the Yankees, oh no, that was a no-no, you know? Now when you look at them, they're all probably talking about their agents and their salaries and whatever else they wanted. There's a lot of chit-chat out there, and I know that has certainly changed because there were managers who would find their players if there was any friendship or camaraderie between the teams. You know, the hockey players in the old six-team NHL, they traveled by train, right? And sometimes they'd be on the same train. Like if you played in Boston against Montreal in Montreal on a Saturday, and then you took the train to Boston from Montreal for a game at the Garden on Sunday, they were usually in different passenger in sleeper cars or whatever. And there were players, if they walked into the dining room and they saw players from the other team eating, they would walk out until the other team had left, and then they would go have their food. Absolutely true.
And that would never happen today.
No. First of all, they wouldn't be on a train.
Well, in the early football days when you had the Providence Steamrollers as the first professional team in the area, they would play games on 2 days in a row, one on the road, one at home, mm-hmm. against the same team, and they'd travel together to get from one location to the other.
Train travel, but it also goes to the point that in that era, and for a couple of decades, it also made those players felt a lot closer. There's more camaraderie, more team spirit when you travel together all the time.
And in those days, we had indisputable evidence that there was an awful lot of drinking.
Probably. More than likely, yes. And also a lot of card playing. You know, that's how you killed the time. You played cards, you had a drink. But, you know, there was a... And my uncle Herb, he was part of that era. I mean, he would travel with the Bruins. And, you know, the reporters and the media, rather, reporters... And the players often travel together. And many times, this is maybe back in the 40s and 50s or whatever, many times the teams would pay the reporters for their tickets and for their food. And then you wondered why they didn't come down too hard on the team. But that's the way it was.
Right. I remember when, I think it was Dick Raddatz who proclaimed, "We're not going to drink any more this year, but we're not going to drink any less."
That's true. Dick Raddatz. You know how much money Dick Raddatz would probably make today as a relief pitcher?
Oh, boy.
Wow. And even some of the, before the six-team National Hockey League expanded back, I think, around 1967, they went to 12. Now they're about 30 or something. That there were players who were stuck in the American Hockey League, and couldn't move up, and it was very hard, and that's why, that there are a lot of players. And if you listen to Don Cherry once in a while, I remember he would talk about some of the American Hockey League Hall of Famers. He would offer comment on the website for the AHL Hall of Fame, one step below the NHL. And he would say, if that guy was in the NHL now, he'd be making millions. And it's true. Expansion was a good thing. It gave opportunity and exposure. Now I'm not so sure that they have enough really good players for any one team. But it really, a lot of guys who would have been household names were making, $5,000 or $10,000 a season in the minor leagues. And you know what? Some of the great, great players, for them, like I think Milt Schmidt, Woody Dumart, some of the great basketball players, Sharman, so forth, they all had jobs outside of the sport in the off season. I remember, I think Sharman had a driving range up on the North Shore. I think so. Tommy Heinsohn sold insurance.
Yes.
And everyone had to have a second job, even though they were top-flight athletes. And that's kind of sad.
And, boy, how that has changed when you look at college sports now.
Yes.
When you have the NIL.
I'm still trying to figure that one out. But at the same time, I look at the transfer portal in football, in basketball. And there were some guys playing in the championship games in basketball and in football who are like 24, 25 years old, and they're on their fourth or fifth team. And I think that wasn't the purpose of the portal. It was to give them a second chance. But boy, did it exploded, and something needs to be done to, you know, that you can't just go team to team to team. It's just not the way it's supposed to be. Then look at, and if you look at professional hockey, you got rookies coming in into the NHL, I'm sorry, into college, first freshmen in college who are 21, 22 years old, not 18, because they spent three or four seasons playing in junior hockey. It's you know, in the strive to be the best, a lot of lines are crossed, and I don't particularly agree with some of them.
Yeah, but today it's awfully difficult to imagine a freshman football player coming into a college who is being paid more millions than the coach.
Yeah, doesn't say much for the coach, does it?
I mean, they get paid millions before they ever set foot on campus and play any game. And this was, they all are advertised as student athletes, but do they ever get to class?
That's a good question, and all I can say is every time I hear of some guy who's, you know, playing in a bowl game, they said, well, he played at Mississippi this year, he played at Oregon the next year, he played at Kentucky the next year, and here he is, you know, being on a national championship team. I'm not so sure that should be celebrated. I mean, it hasn't been brought under control, and I think it has to be brought under control. But those days, well, growing up, I used to, one of my first jobs at the Globe, I was a correspondent, I was a student at Boston University. I would cover their football and hockey games, and it's how I got, another way I got my start. And everybody on the team was my age, you know? Not anymore. Not anymore.
No, and BU, many people don't realize that BU at one time tried to go big-time football. They brought in Maryland and they brought in Oklahoma, but...
I used to go to the games with my dad.
I went to those games.
I was a teenager. I saw BU take on Syracuse University, and their star was Jimmy Brown.
Okay? Yep.
BU held, you know, they had a good crowd. They stuck with Syracuse for two and a half, three quarters. I never forget it. It was a 14-7 game. BU was trying to tie it up. They didn't quite. They lost 21-7. The difference was, BU had some great athletes on the first string, but they never had the depth. They didn't have the scholarship money to compete with these other teams.
Well, that was the history at Boston College for many years, too.
Yes.
They played a big-time schedule. They'd match up as a first team, but after that, the benches were totally different.
Of course. That's what, and, of course, BU... 2 years before they dropped football, and I know there were financial reasons. There was absolutely financial reasons why a 1AA team couldn't support football because of the scholarships. Then there was Title IX, which certainly was an important piece of legislation. I applaud it. But then the money had to be spread out. And BU, the only reason that they could stay in it was that the late coach, Dan Allen, you know, brought in junior college transfers. And he put them right into the national championship playoffs. 2 years later, they were gone. And it costs so much money for 1AA teams like BU and Northeastern to keep a program going, and they couldn't justify it because it was costing them $1 to $2 million a year, and they weren't going to make it up just even through if they sold out every game, they would be losing a lot of money. So they were doomed.
Well, look at today. They're talking about the money that's going to come for NIL from the settlement against the NCAA, and they're talking about $20.5 million to each of the colleges in the five major leagues, and then the colleges are having to hire people to manage these funds and find a way to distribute them to the players, and it's causing all kinds of problems.
Well, it's a practical problem, and it's a philosophical problem, and on the philosophical end, I'm totally against it.
I think most people would agree with you, except for their team.
You're right. You're absolutely right. But I loved covering college football. I covered a lot of Holy Cross games back in the 90s when they had some great football teams, and enjoyed it very much. You knew that you were in good shape when you covered Harvard games and Holy Cross games if you could lug your computer up to the press box with all the seats that were there. And if you made it up to the top of Harvard Stadium and you weren't panting, then you knew you were in shape.
But these days, it's a totally different world.
Yes, it is. There are some things that remain the same in terms of the emotions and the individual heroics. There are some things that are still worth seeing. I just think that, and I agree with you, that you look at these top teams in football, basketball, you know, you think you're watching a pro game.
Absolutely.
And there's your difference.
Well, part of it may be the fact that many of the pro coaches have come down from the pro league to the colleges.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Bill Belichick is the number one example, but the coach at BC, his experience is in the professional league.
I think he's the perfect coach for BC right now, because I don't think he has any great desire to our aspirations to go back to the NFL. I think this is where he wants to be. That always wasn't the case at BC. It's not damning the people that moved on to jobs in the NFL.
No.
But you needed someone to stay a while. Like O'Brien was there enough years to show his loyalty, for example. Bicknell, too. Coaches like that. The other coaches were not as, they saw that the limits of how far they could go coaching college, and they would go to the NFL. Now look at the previous coach. I think it was with Green Bay, and he did a great job there this season with their defense. So you're going to be in the right place at the right time, and you have to feel at home with what you're doing.
Yeah, people have to realize that in many states, the highest paid employee in the entire state is the head football coach.
Not surprising. And usually it's below the Mason-Dixon line.
Yes.
Yes. But I love covering college football. I used to cover the Yankee Conference. And I remember some of my favorite trips in the nice fall day would be driving out to UMass in the fall, out to Western Massachusetts. That's the days when UMass had some terrific teams and won AA. The coach that I really had great fun with was Jim Reed, was the fellow's name. He later became head coach at Richmond and assistant at Boston College. And after a big win, he'd come into one of the rooms where we would have the post-game press conference. And after one particularly wonderful, great come-from-behind win, he came up to each one of the sports writers and kissed them on their foreheads. But those were fun days, you know?
You don't have that anymore.
Well, to some degree, but not like it was. No. One of the most moving times of my life was after 9/11. And I was writing stories of some athletes who died as a result of it. And I covered a UMass football game after, it was a Saturday after 9/11. And they raised the colors, and they read off the names of UMass alum who died in 9/11. And I sat there, and I thought to myself, this is just the kind of gesture that makes our country great. it was just so moving. And I remember it like it was yesterday. And it was like, they opened up their hearts to their community. And I think that's how we got over some of that trauma, was by banding together. And that UMass band played a couple of great American patriotic songs. They had the flag, and they read off the names, and I'll never forget it. It was just surreal.
We were traveling shortly after 9/11 on the Ohio River, and we were in Middle America. And we went to some of the small towns, and I never saw so many flags and so many people doing patriotic things then as any other time.
Yes, and there was a lot of fear. I remember just after the day or two after was the Red Sox were playing, I was covering the game. And for some reason, I kept looking at the skyline, wondering what's going to happen next. It was just such an emotional, crazy time, and I kept looking at me. Well, they're looking like as if jet planes are going to come flying over the park. It was scary.
Well, let's hope we never have that again.
I certainly agree. But I can tell you that I remember doing. We were asked to do profiles of some of the people who died in the result of 9/11, who were local athletes, local people. Mm-hmm. And I did two or three of them, and the stories were as tough a situation as you could be as a journalist in recalling their lives. It was tough, but it's all part of the job.
Yeah, one of the people who suffered in 9/11 and was killed was a coach from Burlington High School that I had helped hire when I was on the school committee.
Wow.
And I felt that was a close loss.
Was he on the plane out of Boston?
He was on one of the planes out of Boston.
Yeah. I had a family friend who perished on that flight. The Bruins, there was a Bruins player who went into management. I wonder if it was Glenn Sather, but I'm not sure. But somebody passed away who was a member of the Bruins staff and had played for them. So, I mean, it hits when you're writing sports. All of a sudden, you're writing about their passing and sudden passing, and it's a wake-up call. But, you know,
one of the things you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. when you mentioned Title IX,
yes.
we didn't follow through on, but imagine what has happened in the women's sports scene.
Well, it's exploded. I'm very, very happy that we have a women's professional hockey team. We have some great athletes, Olympians, collegiate players. I remember covering my first college women's hockey game with Harvard. And I didn't know much about the college women's hockey. But as I watched them, I was just amazed, and that's my ignorance of it, but I was absolutely amazed at the speed of the game by these top, terrific athletes, and some of them went on to U.S. Olympic teams. The speed of the game, even back then, impressed me, and the fact that now that they can show off their talents, they have pretty good crowds this year.
And certainly women's basketball has advanced at lightning speed.
Yes. I have a feeling that maybe a couple of those, if we had WNBA team in Boston, I've wondered, would it draw? I have a feeling that it would take a little bit of time, but it could be a success. It would depend on where they played.
Ah.
It would be the venue. You don't want 4,000 fans in the TD Garden.
No.
But they look good up at Saugus, that look good at BZ. I think BU would be a great home ring for them.
Well, of course, Northeastern is talking about tearing down the old center that was the Boston Arena,
mm-hmm.
and building a new facility, but I'm not sure we're going to live long enough to see it.
Well, I hope we do. But I think I remember the old Boston Arena because growing up in Boston, my dad and I, we would go to the Boston Arena on Sunday mornings, and it was public skating. And when you looked at the old arena, it was kind of hard to realize it. But that's where the Bruins played their first game.
That's where the Celtics played their first game.
Yep.
And I happened to be there.
Yep. And that wasn't the game when Chuck Connors broke the backbone, was it?
Yes, it was. In the warm-up.
Yes.
And then they waited 45 minutes to get another backboard from the Boston Garden.
Yeah. And the way the Celtics were shooting the last two games, I thought they were going to break the backboard too. But I'm not going to pick on them, but that was a rough one.
Yeah, the last two nights have been, two games have been terrible.
Yes. You got to have a thing is, as a coach, you got to have a plan B. He doesn't have a plan B. He's got plan A. Let them keep shooting their way out of it. That doesn't work.
Yeah, last night I was yelling at the television.
Well, I hope the television didn't yell back at you.
No.
Well, I even the radio announcers last night were begging the Celtics coach to call a timeout, but he wouldn't, so that's a problem.
Do you believe that Pete Rose, Roger Clemens, McGuire, Sosa, and Barry Bonds, all of whom had the statistics, all of whom had the great career, should they be in the Hall of Fame, or was it so unfair to baseball and the competitors over all the years for them to be considered?
I don't think they should be in. And I'll give you the one major reason why. They weren't on the level playing field. And if you put yourself in a position, you know, to bulk up or improve your eyesight or whatever these drugs did, it gave them an unfair playing advantage. And if that's the case, no, they shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. Now, that may be reversed someday when memories gonna fade a little bit. Pete Rose, definitely not.
No, he gambled on baseball.
Yes, he did. And that in itself, he had no business being in the Hall of Fame.
No, and when he gambled on baseball, he had control of the team, and that was the difference.
That's right. But
And yet, Shoeless Joe Jackson was barred, and then it was later established that he had nothing to do with.
But the problem with the eight men out,
yep,
is that some of the stories get muddied over time, and you don't really know. There was one player who proclaimed his innocence all those years. He never took any money. There was some players who definitely took money. But, you know, they never got the money that the gamblers promised them. And, it's a very, very tough one to judge. But the point is that they did accept the bribe, most of them. But
oh, absolutely.
How do you separate it? I mean, if you recall the story, when these players were called up before the grand jury and they testified and everything, when it came time to the trial, their testimony suddenly disappeared. And so, you know, what was going on? Hanky-panky, right?
Yeah, that's not unusual.
No, it's not.
Not in those days.
No, it's not.
Well, if there's something else you'd like to explain to us about the sports scene, either then or now, I'd appreciate hearing from you.
Well, I have a lot of favorite stories, I'll be very frank that when I took a retirement, which was really a buyout, which was a tremendous way to say goodbye to being on the staff. They actually kept me on the staff for a while. And then I started a big chapter in my career that I am extremely proud of, and I say this with all humility. One day, I got a call from the sports editor, Joe Sullivan. He said, Marv, he said, Don Gillis has passed away. He said, and you knew him. I said, yes. And he said, well, how'd you like to do his obituary? And I said, sure. I wrote Don's obituary, and it worked out well. I must have written another 300 or 400 until a couple of years ago. All these people that I covered, and it made it a very personal thing to have people remember these athletes. And they range from several of the Boston Braves, Red Sox. I did other opus, like I did Jungle Jim Loskatoff.
Yes.
Yeah, Clyde LaVellet, Willie Knowles. And in doing these stories, you find things out about them that when they were playing, people really didn't know until you talked to their siblings or their wives or their husbands. You know, this was great, and I took great pride in that, and it was something that you can't. I didn't just finish my career by walking out the door. I finished it by honoring, you know, maybe 200 or 300 or 400 of these great athletes, and it really meant a lot. In fact, when I look back, I wound up doing. You'll love the next story, but before I say that, I did the obituaries of both Gino Cappelletti and Gil Santos. I did those stories. I did Billy Sullivan, and many others. But there was one obituary that I wrote that I found to be pretty special, and it was a guy who was a sports editor at the Herald, who I knew very briefly, and we were fairly friendly, and I was thinking to myself, I said, I hope if there was any way someday when I go, maybe I should write my own obituary from upstairs. It was very important to me to honor these people, and for everything that I did over my career, it was a highlight because you were doing something for families, for friends, and some of my favorite letters are from families and friends and of these people that I wrote about it. One quick story, if we have time.
Sure.
Is one night you talk about the pressure that you're under on deadline, no less. I was filling in for Jackie McMullen in a fairly meaningless Celtics game back when the 90s, when they started to go a little bit bad, right? And word got out that Johnny Most had died, the famous announcer.
Yeah.
Sports said, Marv, he said, drop what you're doing and write Johnny's obituary. So I tracked down a few people who, at the game, Celtics people, made a few calls. I was able to get the story in that night for the next day's paper. At the same time, Ron, I had to write the game story while this is going on, and I had to write a little notes column afterwards, 3-in-1 in one night, right? And that's what people sometimes don't realize. Is, well, you go to the game, you have something to eat, you write a story, you go home. It wasn't that way, because you had separate editions that you had to write for the morning paper. So you had to update your story, go in to get quotes and so forth, and write it all over again. And the thing is that, as it turns out, the next day's Globe, there was Johnny's obit on page one. There was the Celtics game, which they invariably lost during that era. And then there was a note column. And, you know, that is something that where I always said when it came to those deadlines, you either have it or you don't. And if you gave me a week to write a long, investigative story or some kind of feature, you gave me 7 days to do it, I'd probably finish it on the seventh day. Right? But when you're up there and you're under pressure, you don't have that 7 day to do it. You have an hour. And to be able to do that time after time is something that made it very important to me. And another thing that was very important to me, since you asked, was passing on this kind of knowledge and so forth. I taught journalism, Brookline High School, Brookline Adult Ed, Mount Ida College, and I used to take my students into the Globe and give them a little tour. And when I taught at Mount Ida College, a sports journalism course, their final exam was, I took them all to McCoy Stadium in Pawtucket, and the assignment was to find the story in the ballpark. And they had the run of the press box, but they let me do that. And they went all through the ballpark, and then I took their papers, and some of them were just terrific.
Was the story of some of them, of the murals down at that ballpark?
Some of them were, and I used to love Pawtucket, and I'm sorry to see it go, but I went to a game in Worcester last season. I love the ballpark.
Isn't that a great ballpark?
I love the ballpark. The seats were comfortable. The general manager was so kind to me because he remembered my time going down to Pawtucket.
Was that Brooke?
No, Lou, not Lou Schweckheimer, was the other fellow.
Oh.
It'll come to me probably tomorrow when I wake up. But I loved it. I hope to go again this summer. But the Pawtucket story, I'll sign off with this unless you have other questions,
yeah.
I used to be sent to Pawtucket by the Globe to write about the up-and-coming minor leaguers. One of them was Lou Maloney, who's now on the air with the Red Sox on TV. Fun story. I interviewed him. He was from Framingham, as you well know.
Right.
And I did stories on him when I was the editor of Globe West, and because he was from Framingham. And so he got to Pawtucket, and I was interviewing him, and I got everything done. And after he was done, he said, "Hey, Marvin." I said, "What is it?" He said, "Please, whatever you put in the story, don't tell... I don't want my mother to know that I'm smoking tobacco, you know, I'm chewing tobacco." So I said, "Nope, it won't be in the story. No chewing of the tobacco." And when I would see him at Fenway, I was there for his first Red Sox game, I believe, home game. He hit a home run. I went racing into the stands, and it was to interview his family. But I didn't mention the chewing of the tobacco. So I am actually researching, hopefully, a nice memoir for friends, relatives, and so forth. And I have a lot of things I could say, but I have a lot of fun stories, a lot of emotional things. But, you know, I wouldn't trade in one moment of it. Nope.
Tell me, how were you affected by the recent Duran story? That was different than anything we've had.
It was very courageous of him to mention it. He deserves a lot of credit. And the fact that somebody, you know, did something idiotic and, got into a shouting at him or whatever it was, it's still a courageous act. I think he did the right thing. But it's not, in this day and age, or in any day and age, it's not unusual that someone is going to take advantage of that. And he probably had an idea it would happen. But I just think it was a very courageous thing to do, and I hope it helps other people.
I think it will. I think that's a good place to end. But before we finish, I want to read to my listeners what you said about your Globe years.
Okay.
And I think this is a wonderful tribute. "Marvin, you said I took every assignment with pride that the Boston Globe chose me to do. It was never an ego trip, but a great responsibility to do my best. The passion has never abated." What a wonderful statement, and what a wonderful way to treat your life job. And I thank you for being with me today.
Yes.
It's a great pleasure. After all these years, I got the chance to question you. So,
you know, we should have changed jobs just for one day way back then. What do you think?
So, folks, you've been listening to Audio Journal's Sports Stories with Hark, our effort to look at local, national, and international stories in sports. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archive editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. This is Mr. Ron. If you have any information on any other human interest stories and would like us to share it with our listeners, give us a call at 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.org. Thank you for listening.